right here, right now. Every day, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city. Toronto.
This program is sponsored by A Different Book List. Located at 779 Bathurst Street, A Different Book List is an African-Canadian-owned bookstore specializing in the rich literature of African and Caribbean diaspora and the Global South. For more information, visit www.adifferentbooklist.com.
Good morning and welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to just try to cover all the remarkable events that are unfolding very rapidly and with a kind of sense of danger, in, I suppose, in people's minds that they will start interconnecting and set off something really big or bigger. To begin with, I always want to do this one, to say that the U.S. military, the Pentagon, U.S. policy, when they engage with any any of their minions around the world, they do they guarantee to themselves full spectrum dominance, and therefore, you have to be very alert. And, of course, if you, maybe you're just born alert. And if you are, then you know to be, take everything with a grain of salt. But there is a portion of the population described by W.C. Fields when he said that a sucker is born every minute. Actually, it wasn't Fields. It was probably the the great P.T. Barnum. Hey, I can read lips. Pedro said P.T. Barnum, and I, bingo, I hit it. A sucker is born every minute. Just before coming to the station, I looked at New York Times getting ready to tell us about the world today, and one of their editors was talking about the Islamic Republic of Iran and news from there, and she had a nice phrase, a telltale phrase. She said Iran is anti-American, the anti-American government of Iran. And so that's kind of, so in other words, for the ordinary reader, there's somebody out there who doesn't like you, the reader, doesn't like us Americans, and and so we obviously, the suggestion would be we better have a policy to deal with them. Actually, the problem going on right now is because we do have a policy to deal with them. We had a demonstration. There are some here. There are demonstrations going on in Iran, or so it's reported, and of some size, and the primary figures who are benefiting here are those who are calling for the return of the Shah of Iran, which is quite a remarkable historical joke, actually. To speak to directly to the woman who said, the editor at the New York Times, that Iran is anti-U.S., let's remember the reason, and that is that there was in Iran a coup organized by the CIA to remove the elected leader of Iran in 1953, I believe it was. And you have to remember, this leader, his crime, This, and as you will know from watching Venezuela and elsewhere, the crime of crimes was that he had nationalized, or intended to, I don't think he got away with it, he intended to anyway, the Standard Oil and I couldn't give it a Shell, I guess, and all those. At any rate, he thought the minerals and petroleum base of Iran should belong to the Iranian people, and that was his fatal mistake. So it was British intelligence and U.S. intelligence, CIA, under a colorful gentleman named Roosevelt. He was the grandson, nephew of Teddy Roosevelt. He was the main organizer. None of this is speculation or it was absolutely happened with a plan and has been written up by many parties who participated. And those I'm speaking of are proud of what they did, that they overthrew the elected government of Iran and put in power a pretender, the Shah. And the effect of that was to create an animus in the population so that the effrontery of the U.S. and its partners to destroy their, what was obviously the popular wish, and would obviously, you aren't a sovereign country, by the way. If you don't control your own resources, then you're not sovereign. So it was an attack on all the people of Iran. And that is the beginning of the problem, of the anger that the editor of the Times spoke of. And here we are today, where you can find photographs of Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and the son of the Shah, and of Trump also with the son of the Shah. So your choice, if you're in Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, whether it's 1953 or 2026, it's either you have a government that fights for its sovereignty against the wishes of the Western powers, or you have the Shah. That's all you have. Those are the choices. And we are finding, I'm really struck by this, that they insist on the monarchical system, that they have to, it has to be him. There's all kinds of little names that you could toss around, or this one or that one, but at the end of the day, what it really they want to show is that we are the ones who will decide who you will decide for, and it's going to be the Shah. There was, say, 5-6 years ago, I think people would have laughed at this and said, oh, no, that's not the, it's not, there's multiple choices and there's all kinds of alternative leaders, you know, here and there. But as it gets closer to the day, as the bombs are dropped on Iran, as their leaders are assassinated, as sanctions are quadrupled, including by Canada and all those, and all kinds of actions are taken against them, we get closer to that time when they think they can bring about a turnover, I would call it a counter-revolution. It has to be their guy. And this is a pattern. Maybe you might say, if you're a political scientist, this is, for some reason, built into conflicts. But the analogy, you can make an analogy with the French Revolution, where they overthrew the king, removed the king. By the way, that wasn't their object, wasn't to remove the king. The object was to get a people's, a government, if the king, who at the time in, of the French Revolution said he favored the revolution, he appeared on a balcony and said, I'm with you, briefly. But then they found out he wasn't, and it led to his losing his head. But that process of eliminating, of having a monarch as your choice is what we see in going on now. It did happen in France that they removed the monarchy. They established a republic, the sin of sins at the time. That was Bolshevism in that period. So they established a people's government, a republic based on the will of the wishes of the people. And so the surrounding royal families and masters of Europe said, well, they would go to war with France for that. And they said at the beginning, we have to restore the monarchy to France. And so the wars went on, several. It went, if there were how many, some, I forget how many coalitions they formed to bring down the French government, which insisted it was going to have its, you know, it's going to be a republic. And eventually, in 1813, 14, they won. And then, of course, there was a brief attempt to bring Bonaparte back, which failed. And then they restored the king. You would think that, okay, the French people have had a revolution. They clearly want the style of government which is more representative. They want respect for the citizens. They want all these things. They don't want huge division of between the wealthy class and the poor. So we should work out something. No, they insisted it's going to be the king. And of course, when Bonaparte returned in 1815, the king had to flee again. But then they brought him back, and then a few years went by, and the people went to the streets again. And so finally, they had to give up on the idea of a king. It took about a half century of killing each other and burning buildings and all that. But the tenacity of our ruling elites to have it their way is most striking. And that's what's going on now. It's going to be their way. It's going to be their guy. It's not going to be, you know, we're not saying, oh, you're going to have a plebiscite. Or no, you're going to have him. And he is the Shah in waiting. Not that he's going to succeed. I don't want to give anybody the impression I think he's going to win. But he has been visiting the appropriate capitals, Washington and Tel Aviv. And both Israel and the United States are talking loudly about intervening. They've already intervened in that only a few months back, Donald Trump bombed Iran, and Israel and Iran had a heavy exchange, and it's clear to me that they intend to do it some more, and Trump is saying as much. He says if they continue with this repression, that he's going to do something. And in the West, we have a completely blank sheet of people who think they know what they're talking about when they say they're anti-imperialist, who don't say anything about this, because they have a thing about people having religion or their own way of doing things, does not conform to the agenda of Western leftists, they stand by while Trump carries these things out. Now, by the way, these things are related, these developments are related to events in Venezuela and Cuba. Today, as you know, in the past 2 days, piracy has been made a sacred cause, and vessels containing with Venezuelan oil are being grabbed on the high seas by the U.S. And so we don't have any international agency such as UN capable at this point of doing anything about it. Canadians say they are concerned about Trump looking at Canada and saying, I want your minerals and oil and all that. But when he does it to Cuba, or he does it to Venezuela, and certainly not when he does it to Iran, does anybody care? They all, in that sense, are vassals. They think like vassals, and they're all in favor of him mugging somebody else. It's just that we don't want to get mugged, but we would prefer he not mug us. But if he's mugging somebody else, we're there. Canada has sanctions on Iran. Canada followed suit, did everything they could do and are still doing it. Harper closed the embassies of the Iran that was here. They did it to Syria because they intended to overthrow Syria. They succeeded with Syria. And nobody here has any compunction about it. We said the individual currently ruling Syria was a terrorist, all we had to favor show that was mounds of evidence and, of course, dead bodies and cut throats. But now he has a suit on, and we're all prepared. He's a fine fella, and can't do better than that. Totally cynical and dishonest. Iran definitely has economic problems, so are you proud of yourselves that you put sanctions on them from day one, harassed them, that you provided arms and intelligence from day one of their removal of the Shah? From day one, you've been working to create a siege on that country in order to bring it down. And then you say, as they do about Cuba, well, look, they're a failed state. It's a failed economy. They're corrupt. Why don't you pat yourself on the back? You did it. You put the sanctions. You arrested their citizens. You did everything to create what is becoming very rapidly in the past year, I'd say, a siege of almost everybody that the U.S. doesn't like, now up to and including seizing ships on the high seas, but we're approaching, I would think, a blockade, more blockades, Venezuela, Cuba, and there will be action taken, and Ottawa should step out and brag about what it did to help bring this about. I have to say, I look across the political spectrum, and I don't see any Canadian politician doing anything other than kissing up and barking or making the usual sounds of a happy little animal that's participated in a murder, and pretending that this has something to do with the wishes of the Iranian people. There's a phrase that's going around that we should comment on this, and that is that those who are organizing the violence in Iran, I understand they have economic problems and there are demonstrations, but this has turned into something where you can clearly see that organized elements who wish to destroy the government, not repair the economy, but to destroy the government, are acting out. Anybody's ever been around a large demonstration will know that there are people who come who have an entirely separate agenda, and either from left, right, or center, where they intend to cause havoc. And the havoc people are very much in attendance in these crowds. But the little phrase that they use is they say, this time it's different. It feels different. Well, I would say, for example, I got that phrase again today in the New York Times, but I've been reading, of course, the New York Times since I can remember. And this is about the 12th time I've seen that phrase appear in those journals over the years. Oh, this time it's different. Well, one of these days it may be, but actually what you're trying to say is, okay, that means if it's different, then qualitatively different things have to happen. And our solidarity with sanctions and assassinations and attempts to put another Shah back in power, it's time to get busy and do that. By the way, vassals like Canada and the other states that always do what Trump tells them, they like to use a situation like this to change their relationship to the master, to say, well, okay, now I'm going to be on side with him. He's going to like me better now because I'm going to help him. And you see, boss, I'm out here, I'm working double time, and you didn't even ask me to. I'm knocking myself out here. That's what they're going to do. And they're going to expect to get a little favor. They're going to get a favor, all right, and it's not the type they expected. So this is the situation. And I wanted to point out that, again, to all the ignoramuses who pretend that they are part of the left or that they have some great internationalist dream, what malarkey they're engaging in when they support the counter-revolutionaries trying to destroy Iran and put the Shah back in power. When they don't, of course, say they're doing that. They just love whoever it is who's giving the current government a hard time. I would say almost majority of I would call them false progressives are very committed to Cuba, as well they should be. Cuba had an extraordinary revolution that startled. It really did shake the world that they could overthrow a dictatorship and then fight off an attack, which was led by, triggered by John F. Kennedy. It was his decision, the Bay of Pigs. And so Cuba has always, I think, enjoyed a special place in the hearts of people who want to see change in our hemisphere and around the world. They want that a government that is devoted to the people. What's, the Lincoln phrase, of the people, by the people, for the people. By the way, Fidel liked to say that to remind the Americans of their own ideas, which they had discarded. But Cuba's in a tough spot now because Trump is saying he's decided to go for the – he's going to try to – what is it they say in snooker? He's going to clean the table or clear it or whatever it is. every ball is going to drop. He's going to get Venezuela. He's going to get Cuba. He's going to get Iran. And it isn't – those who – stand by Cuba, just absolutely, but have bad-mouthed the Islamic Republic are forgetting something. The Islamic Republic and Cuba are friends, and Venezuela and the Islamic Republic and Cuba are friends. And we have a left that likes to cherry pick. I like that one. I like his hair. Or the other guy has a nice beard. Or that was a great speech. It's just all malarkey. The fact is, these countries found that when they challenged U.S. power, that they were in for it, and they looked to people who, to others who had challenged, who were challenged U.S. power, and I don't mean they're the only three friends. I just point out there's three among others. But the crucial thing is to recognize that the perpetrators, and Canada is among the perpetrators, but the U.S. is the power that has created, first of all, the revolutions and then the resistance such as it is. It was all result of the U.S. position of requiring absolute hegemony. Absolute, and by hegemony, I mean they will appoint who your government is. They'll take it over and they will appoint. Trump has a is in that situation at the moment. And I think we'll take that up as a separate theme. We have a little song. I guess it's Bob Dylan, isn't it? We'll play that and we'll come back on that. I'm being told maybe we have that song. Do we? All right, we'll play that and we'll come back.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you must say that I'm young. You must say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, All the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon.
There we go. Seems appropriate. Bob Dylan, from a time when U.S. was coming to a bad end in Vietnam, and making everything worse as they departed. We said on the show last week, it's kind of important to note that, this thing of America coming back, America being great again, has to do, I'd say too much of it, to do with what happened in Vietnam, where the military class and those who admire militarism went into a state of shock, and the American people tried to correct what had, how the policies that had got them into this mess, and they very closely scrutinized leaders, and for what had occurred, and it took years for the militarists and the hard right in America to get back on its feet. And the way it did it was to start saying, we're patriots, we weren't defeated, we just had leaders who weren't up to it, ready to go whole hog. And they also said that American people were anti-soldier. They didn't love our soldiers, love our troops. We really love them now. We have flags from one end of the football field to the other, and everybody doffs their hat, which is all a farce because the way they treat veterans is shabby, and soldiers have always been just the old phrase, cannon fodder. And I guess this would be an appropriate time to urge everybody to go online and read a great book that's available. You can always find it free by a U.S. Marine Corps General, Smedley Butler, and it's called War is a Racket. And I'll paraphrase him. He said, I would know. He said, I was the muscle to overthrow the government in Nicaragua and to go ashore and kill people in up and down the hemisphere. He said, and all I was doing was benefiting Standard Oil. He specifically mentioned Standard Oil. And the sugar companies, he says I was just a high-priced muscle guy. He says, we weren't any different than gangsters. Given the fact that he was Smedley Butler, a very bemedaled leader. By the way, he talked about medals. He said, you want to make a man into a fool, you give him a medal. He said, you can get people to do awful things if they know they're going to get a medal. And he said that to warn people about how susceptible they were to little baubles that get them to do something silly. But the main point there is that they staged a comeback by getting into a flag contest as to who had the biggest flags and all that. And the Democrats were caught, what do they call it? They were wrong-footed. So they now make sure that they have flags wall to wall because you have to show you love the troops. And if you love the troops, then you love the commander, and then you go and you commit crimes as much as you like. But Smedley Butler, well, do look him up. It's one of the little moments, and it's very apropos to what is going on now. This matter of the vessels seizing ships on the high seas is as close as you can get. It's in terms of if you want to provoke a flash war, that can happen because United States has no authorization only itself declared a lawless right to take vessels belonging to a sovereign country, or the oil is aboard, and also not only to take it but to sell it, which I think going to raise a question for Canadians and others around the world. Are you going to buy oil from a pirate? Because this is piracy. And the pirate says, well, I'm just, you know, I'm doing it and it's for sale. So I did see an op-ed piece in the Globe and Mail by a respectable business type, and he says, we must not buy stolen oil. We cannot do that. But I would assume he's in the minority. We'll see whether he is or not. But we could probably remind ourselves and the Americans that the War of 1812, as it's called, was started on a decision by President of the United States saying that the British were stopping American vessels, seizing American vessels on the high seas, and they were capturing, they were taking U.S. Sailors, these would be civilians, forcing them to serve in the British Navy. And the Americans went to war under the slogan. I don't know if people know, in the War of 1812, the slogan, the American slogan was free trade and free sailors. That their sailors had a right to be, you know, not molested and taken away and forced to serve in someone else's navy. But they had a right to trade with whom they wanted to trade, because the reason the British were stopping the vessels is that the Americans were trading with France, and they had an embargo on France. And so if they felt like it, they came aboard and took the sailors. One little twist that might interest people is that they would question the crew when they captured a ship, and they didn't always take everybody. Of course, they left them able to, they didn't take everybody into the Navy. But one of the things they did, and you can find this in history books, is that they would question the crew, and if they heard an Irish accent, they'd say, that man's with us, comes with us. He is a British subject. So when they heard the accent, and I know there was a story told by an American Army officer who was himself captured, and he heard the British questioning sailors, and he ran onto the deck and said, no one answer any question. Don't say anything, because they're looking for Irish accents. If they hear an accent, that is automatically a British subject. So don't say anything. Nice. Bless his heart. That was Winfield Scott, I believe, captured at Queenston Heights. So at any rate, the Americans don't seem to remember that they were they went to war because somebody stopped one of their ships, not one of them, several ships. And of course, Americans aren't big on irony, but at any rate, we should know these things, and we should be loud and clear, and there should be a demand that all states refuse to do business, any oil business, with the Americans, because they're actually stealing somebody else's oil and selling it. Or at least that's what Trump says he's going to do. As I start off the program today, I've mentioned this full spectrum dominance, and one ABC element of it is information. You will remember, if we were talking, I guess, all Canadians talking to each other about the news from Venezuela last week, Trump treated it as a done deal. Everything was finished. He had stolen the president of Venezuela and his wife. And he said, we are going to run Venezuela. And actually, at this point, the media still seems to be on that track. However, the reality is that the Venezuela is still Venezuela. Their parliament is still their parliament. The vice president has followed the constitutional mode, the protocols, and she's the acting president. And the position of the Venezuelans today remains President Maduro has been kidnapped, and he is and he remains Venezuela's president, and of course his wife is a high-ranking member in the National Assembly or Parliament, and they have to be returned. So where is this overwhelming knockout victory that Trump seems to be talking about, and why is he still taking oil if he has it all fixed up? Venezuela hasn't been tested in the sense that they're running their own affairs. And this is and the world is in a state of, political leaders all over the world say this is really not the way to do things. Although, of course, our prime minister is largely silent. The NATO position is that Maduro was a dictator and he was a criminal or some such thing, which is absolutely no relevance. The point has nothing to do with the subject, which is the sovereignty of Venezuela, and which means that the sitting president, however he got there, is not the business of Ottawa. And if he's taken by another power, that is a violation of international law and the UN Charter and the whole, and of the U.S. Constitution at the end of the day. So, but there's people, conniving at this and rationalizing it. But the main point is that Venezuela is still under the authority of its people in government, and all kinds of strange things have happened. I mean, we have to throw in all the jokes. I mean, the woman who won the Nobel Prize with the assistance of the Americans, that is, they extracted her from Venezuela so that she could go and get the prize. And then Trump announces that she's really not credible, and she's not going to be the leader. And here all the Western media had beat themselves up with the hailing her as a Nobel Prize winner, as the real leader of Venezuela. And then Trump knocks over the table by saying, well, she's not credible, and she's not, And so then everybody has to drop that and leave her sitting on the floor. But she is coming, they say, to Washington, and she says she's going to give the Nobel Prize she received to the man who just gave her a hard boot down the hallway, but she's still going to come and do that. And then the Nobel Prize people say, well, actually, she can't do it because we didn't give the prize to him. We gave it to her. They'll all lose their jobs for this, by the way. But so, in other words, the news in Venezuela, while it's very worrying, it remains that the Venezuelan government is in place. And I think they're playing mind games with this thing of Delcy Rodriguez, who is the vice president, Rubio, and Trump pretending that everything she says is not what she says. It's sort of an Orwellian thing where they say something, she contradicts them, and then they say, well, that's not what she tells us. So it's a farce waiting, I guess, to become a tragedy. But remember that Trump also threatened to kill her. He's threatened, of course. I mean, that's not news. He's threatened to kill a bunch of people. But he did say that she better do the right thing, or otherwise it'll be worse for her. I don't know that this show of his is going to play out. There's a nervousness in the ranks you can see around him. A topic that comes to mind, though, that I think of it, that, again, I'm speaking to what I believe is the shortcomings of so-called progressive forces in the Western world, is that everyone is saying and agreeing that Maduro was kidnapped. And it's like a one-off. This is the most awful thing that, you know, the U.S. has done. Crazy exercise of imperialist power, using a commando operation to seize a foreign leader. So I want to mention that President Gbagbo, if you don't know his name, that's former President Gbagbo of Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, was kidnapped. And why was he kidnapped from Ivory Coast in 2010, I believe? He had won the election. Now, how do I know he won the election? Well, because they had the election process. He was challenged by a right-wing element. And they have a parliament. They have journals. They have political parties. His party, he was the serving president. He was running for re-election, I believe. And the Supreme Court, as in any other country with a Supreme Court and with a parliament, when there is a disputed result of the election, see Don Trump 2020, there's a process when there's a challenge. And nobody likes the outcome if they were on the losing side or the one declared. Of course, they don't like it. But the process was gone through, and the Supreme Court found that Gbagbo had won. So, well, that didn't satisfy us because we know best. We live in the West, and we have fancy newspapers and all that stuff, and we have people that we actually think have brains who tell us things. So we were told he didn't win. So what happened? Well, France came together with Kofi Annan's UN special element, and they captured and kidnapped Gbagbo out of Ivory Coast. And they charged him because they said there had been riots and the good guys had been harmed in the riots, and he was the criminal behind it all because he was a sitting president. So he and his wife, now that I'm getting it, I realize there's a little rhyme or echo of what's going on now, but he and his wife were captured by commando elements under UN leadership, United Nations, Kofi Annan, and the French, I'm going to say this, imperialists, they came in and tore him out of his home, and then they flew him, what do you know, to The Hague. Now, you hear all these people say, oh, you have to go to The Hague, the ICC is a wonderful... No, the ICC is an imperialist instrument. They took Gbagbo, the president of Cote d'Ivoire, and what did they do with him? They sat him down for 10 years. And what happened? Then they said, oh, what do you know? We don't actually have a case. You can go, Mr. Gbagbo. You can go. That's the president. He's been robbed of everything. His people were robbed. And then... you had this Ouattara, I think I mispronounced it, probably on purpose. He's now the president. And he decided that Mr. Gbagbo can't run again. He's barred because the usurper gives himself the power to deny the people of Ivory Coast the candidate that they had stolen from them. in 2010. Now, that shows you that the ICC, which people say, oh, let's send Netanyahu to The Hague, or let's send this other guy to gotta go to The Hague. Baloney. The ICC is a well-financed body that says it's acting for international justice. And what does it do? It arrests Africans. If you have an African leader that did something, okay, well, he can be arrested. We put him on trial. By the way, they never convict any of them. You know what the trick is? It's taking people out of circulation. You have a guy who's popular. Gbagbo is very popular. He's a socialist, by the way. And he's popular. So you take him away from the people in the name of international justice, and then he can never recover because you've put him on ice. He's finished. Funny I should say ice, but they take him out of circulation. And they're doing it right now to Mr. Duterte of the Philippines. Duterte is one of the most popular leaders of the Philippines. One of the reasons he's popular and the reason they did it is that he said he's not going to engage in a war with China to make America happy. He said, I want to see good relations with all the parties, and I'm not going to be pushed into a conflict. He was succeeded by the way, as he served out his term as president, he was succeeded by a leader who was from a famous family of collaborators with the U.S., who now is acting very belligerent towards China. So the reason Duterte was taken from the Philippines to go to The Hague is to get him out of the way so that their little war plans can continue unimpeded. That's all it is. And he did not. The Philippines has, they're very proud of it, a democracy. They have a Supreme Court. They have a parliament. He was not given his basic rights. He had been gone abroad, had gone, I think, to Hong Kong to give a speech. When he came back, they had a whole show all organized where he never left the airport, and he never went in front of a judge. And they say that the Philippines has democracy. Why didn't he give? He's a former president. And if they believe he had committed crimes, that's their business. They should put him on trial. They have a court. Let them have. But this is imperialist justice, where they understand that to try to muscle him in a broadly popular leader. I'm not saying the most popular. I don't know, but a broadly popular leader with a distinct opinion on war and avoiding it. They said, "Oh well, you know, that happened. We shouldn't let that. That was probably a mistake." Well, yeah, sure, of course, you're all involved in it, and he's been snatched. So he's basically kidnapped. So the ICC is not the International Court of Justice. That's the International Court of Justice is the proper one, established by the UN from the beginning, and it said we will. That court is constituted to deal with cases between states. But this blasted thing called the ICC says the imperialists will decide whether or not somebody has committed a crime in his own country, and we'll go and get him. That's all that is. That's imperialism. Looked it up last night. Who pays for the ICC? And the main contributors are Germany, France, England, and Japan. Did I say Japan already? That's who pays for the blasted court. Now, who pays the piper calls the tune? This is absurd. Why is it that Africans are the main elements who are charged? Well, because it's a racist European court. And remember, Japan considers itself European. Way, way back, they decided they were of a special imperial breed, and they were permitted to be members of the club. The other thing the Japanese are doing is now trying to get around their World War II commitment to be a peaceful country. That is supposed to be an actionable offense. The United Nations was created out of the countries that defeated Japan. So Japan doesn't get to have a free hand here. And they said they happily agreed not to try to become a militarist power. But times have changed. So they and Germany are both getting back in the game. So that's to my mind, it's important. There should be no anyone who calls themselves a self, class conscious or anti-imperialist or whatever. You can't believe in the ICC paid for by UK, France, Japan, and Germany. Grow up. I mean, and given, now we have Mr. Superpower himself breaking every blasted rule. This is no time to bother with. It is a time to see who is supporting him by doing this, what was done to Duterte and what was done to Gbagbo. And incidentally, those are just the two that come off the top of my head. There are others. So I think we're very near the end of this operation. According, Pedro's a magician, so he can make me say things. We have a few seconds to go. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll see you next week, and here comes some good music. Oh, I should say, it's Little Flame, is it not? By Cassie Blanton. She was part of the Gaza Flotilla. She's a great performer.
A cotton field, a silver mine, Johannesburg to Palestine, broken treaties, dreams deprived. We kept the little flame alive. Bobby Seale to Bobby Sands, a picket held in frozen hands, sat down on I-95 to keep the little flame alive. 100 years,
100 years,
100 more,
100 more.
We throw our weight,
throw our weight
against the door,
against the door.
And even if,
and even if
we don't survive,
we don't survive,
we keep that little flame alive. Ford the river, cross the sea, a slave, a rat, a refugee. Strap the child to your side, keep the little flame alive. Ho Guevara Connolly, we hid them in the scullery. A secret whispered by the wives, kept the little flame alive. 100 years,
100 years,
100 more,
100 more.
We throw our weight,
throw our weight
against the door,
against the door.
And even if,
even if
we don't survive,
we don't survive,
we keep that little flame alive.
Keep that little flame alive.
Faye Dolores Bernadine, table grapes and gasoline, homemade rifles, kitchen knives, kept the little flame alive. Warsaw, Tulsa, wounded knee, they buried us, but we were seeds. And singing from the grave, we rise to keep the little flame alive. 100 years,
100 years,
100 more,
100 more.
We throw our
against the door,
against the door. And
even if
we don't survive,
we don't survive,
we keep that little flame alive.
Keep that little flame alive.
Remember when they shot Joe Hill? He spoke his last and final to all of you. Don't cry, but keep the little flame alive.
This Today's program is sponsored by A Different Book List, located at 779 Bathurst Street. For more information, visit www.adifferentbooklist.com.